books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today in an episode recorded on location at the Boswell Book Festival, I talked to two very different authors who both narrated their own books. Dame Harriet Walter will tell me about her book She Speaks, What Shakespeare's Woman Might Have Said. And sports commentator Dougie Donnelly tells me about his recorded highlights, My Life in Sport. All that, plus we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. My next guest is a very familiar voice to any listener of audiobooks. While her TV and movie career has seen her in Succession, Wolf Hall in Ted Lasso, Sense and Sensibility, Black Mirror, and even treating Chewbacca's wounds in Star Wars The Force Awakens. She's also been prolific behind the microphone, voicing Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, Atonement by Ian McEwan, Hard Times by Dickens, and many, many others. Although I was there to speak to Harriet about just one book, She Speaks, What Shakespeare's Woman Might Have Said. New parts for 30 of Shakespeare's Women, letting them speak their minds, written by the stage and screen actress Dame Harriet Walter, who also, of course, narrates the audiobook.
If I could time travel, I would go back to London in the 1590s and early 1600s to see one of Shakespeare's plays performed by the Lord Chamberlain's men or the King's men. I'm bursting with curiosity to know how they acted in those days. And most especially, since actresses weren't allowed on the stage for another half century or so, to see how boys and young men portrayed Rosalind, Mistress Quickly, Cleopatra, or Lady Macbeth. Theatre was a relatively new art form to the citizens of London, and the city itself was a small place, so the pool of boy actors Shakespeare could draw on wouldn't have been made up of future Laurence Oliviers and Ian McKellens. For the most part, they were probably quite shouty and unsubtle schoolboys, pulling faces and hamming it up. Hamlet's advice to the travelling players not to saw the air too much or tear a passion to tatters gives one a bit of a clue as to what Shakespeare himself warned his company against. But he was also aware that high art would be caviar to the general, and that an average contemporary audience wouldn't be too concerned about the nuances of acting. It was enough to be in the buzzy atmosphere of a playhouse being told an exciting story. This is all speculation. Frustratingly, we will never know the truth. Theatre is an art form that by its very nature insists you had to be there.
She Speaks is a collection of verses and speeches that I have made up cheekily to make up for what I think is a lack in the voices of women in Shakespeare plays. I don't think he's biased in any particular way. It's just that his plots are very male-centred and male-driven, as the world was. I mean, they were running countries and they were, you know, they were the ones causing revolutions and wars and you know, they were protagonists, and women are in the plays mostly, I think almost exclusively, in as much as they are supporters or daughters or wives or mothers of the main guy.
I once read that a young male player would be expected to have a command of rhetoric, to speak well, have good facial expressions, and an aliveness of movement. So I suspect that acting in those days owed more to expert mimicry and physical posturing than anything close to the interiority and authenticity the modern actor is expected to bring to the stage. Did a boy player ask, "What's my motivation?" or have to dredge up some method-like emotional memory in order to play a part? I rather doubt it. In the small window between recruitment at about age 10 and first beard growth, later than nowadays, so around 18, A young actor could become an expert in his field and play girls and women outwardly very convincingly. What they couldn't do was speak from the experience of being a girl or a woman. They would never say to Shakespeare, "I think Gertrude needs to answer back here," or, "Can you give me a bit more of a speech about what Lady Capulet feels about her daughter dying?" Or, "Can you explain why Lear's daughters, Goneril and Regan, are so hateful?" In this book, I've had the temerity to invent some answers to some of these and other questions that the modern actress and a modern audience might wish to ask. I worship Shakespeare and feel very irreverent, shamelessly piggybacking on his giant shoulders. His psychological insight is second to none. His language is miraculous. His daring with forms and his coinage of some 2,000 new words make him a great experimenter. He held the mirror up to nature as no one else before or since. But being a 16th century man, his mirror sometimes gives only a sliver of reflection of women and women's lives. It is a beautiful sliver, but limited in scope.
Now, to give these characters voices, you must have an intimate knowledge of the Shakespearean plays you're drawing from.
Well, it was a mixture. It was easier to write when I'd played a part, because it came fairly quickly to me, because I'd thought a lot about the character and I'd existed inside the character for months and months, sometimes 2 years. So those were the easy ones. But the ones that I was interested in, I wanted to crack open some of the parts I hadn't played. And I remain dissatisfied about that. I don't think you can really understand a character till you've played it. At least I can't. So I speculated, I put words in their mouth, and I realised that I was writing my thoughts rather than their thoughts, and it was imperfect in that way. But there were other things that came out of that exercise that were revealing to me and interesting and fun. It was fun to do.
And you even wrote a rap.
I wrote a rap, The Witches in Macbeth, that, you know, we don't quite know what to do with them when we stage the play, because they certainly can't be what they were to Shakespeare's audiences, which is genuinely frightening witches. So I didn't quite know what to do with them, and I just thought, well, they're old and they're hags and people are prejudiced against them and believe they've got evil powers. And then I thought, well, that's what a lot of people think of old women anyway, so maybe I'll write the witch's rap, and they reveal quite a lot about how they really think.
If Shakespeare wasn't the poet for all time, whose truths are held to be eternal, this wouldn't be too much of a problem. But many of his characters have become almost immortal. Perhaps the most universally famous character in fiction is Hamlet. He has come to represent every man. He is the great articulator of the human condition. And women, as well as men, are accustomed to identifying with this Danish prince from a very different time. If we were to swap things round, would men similarly identify with a female character as representative of all humankind? These are some of the thoughts I had as I pondered the long shadow of Shakespeare's genius and tried to think of ways to let a little sunlight in on some of his women's stories. I like to think he wouldn't mind. I haven't tried to imitate him or write in cod Elizabethan language, but I have found a natural and helpful structure in the iambic pentameter. 5 didums to a line with the occasional trochaic dumdy that he used. Paradoxically, I found it easier to write in rhyming couplets or sonnet form than in blank verse, the same number of didums but without the rhymes, because that suddenly looks like serious poetry and leaves my choice of words more exposed somehow. Shakespeare frequently broke his own rules of rhythm and rhyme, but he can get away with it because of the depth of his poetic thinking and dramaturgy. A large part of the enjoyment of the writing was to find out how much I have absorbed of Shakespeare's rhythms and imagery simply by dint of having played 21, yes, I counted, of his roles. These characters exist in the framework of the verse. The pulse of their thoughts is laced through their speeches, and over 5 decades of internally listening to them and then speaking those lines out loud, I was excited to find how naturally these invented verses came to me.
Now, through the magic of editing, the listeners will have heard you reading from the book. How was that process?
Well, I love that, but I'd also like to go back and do it again in some ways, because when I first did it, it was very much immediately, I think it was before publication of the actual book. So I think I've found all sorts of new readings into the lines that I've got from people's reactions. But, you know, it's a privilege to actually get to read your own words out loud. And we changed things as we went along. There were some words that just didn't quite fit or something, and I changed them in the audio and then got them into the real book.
That's the benefit of recording the audio before publication. You can do that. You can edit it as you're reading.
Absolutely. And I'm very much somebody who has to hear things before I can write them, funnily enough. I mean, people are all different in the way they write, but I'm very much somebody, and I learn my lines very much musically through hearing. So that was really, it was very important to me always to read my stuff out loud. And that told me very clearly what was missing in the beat or what didn't work or what held things up, what let things flow. And that's all very to do with the music of it when you hear it sounded out.
Do speak them aloud if you like that sort of thing. I hope you'll enjoy that. And also enjoy being tantalised by the odd phrase or echo that reminds you of some famous line of the bard's. These don't usually come from the play I'm dealing with in that chapter. My women borrow from one another and toss imagery between them. Just as when playing a classical part, I try to build a bridge between myself and the character and form a kind of hybrid, a sort of Harriet Macbeth or whatever. In the same way, I've written these speeches in a contemporary language while hoping to remain in character. Some are tragical, some comical, tragical, historical, farcical, historical. Most speak alone, but sometimes I bring together women from different plays so they can share and compare their stories. I was alerted to a list available on shakespearswords.com of every Shakespeare role ranked by the number of lines they speak, from Hamlet, who has the most, to some poor guy called Herbert, who only has one line in Richard III. On that list, Rosalind, from As You Like It, is the longest female role, but she is only at number 15. Tellingly, there are only 15 women's roles listed in the top 100. Lady Macbeth is way down at number 138, which makes her lasting impact all the more surprising. In making my choices of who to give voice to, I've tended to focus more on those who don't get much of a look in, or are rather misunderstood, than on those to whom Shakespeare has already given a lot to say. I've also included a few characters that seem to me very gender fluid, and I like to think that Shakespeare, who in his casting could switch a boy to a woman and back again, and play with all the ambiguity in between, would understand.
You're the voice of many audiobooks, this one being yourself, but you've read books by other people, you've read classic books as well. What's the difference between reading your own words and reading someone else's?
It's funny, you have to sort of treat your own work as though it was written by somebody else, funny enough, because you're basically doing the same thing. You're telling a story to an invisible audience out there somewhere. You don't quite know who they are. But it was simpler to do mine because I didn't have to put on lots of funny voices, whereas, you know, when you're reading a story with a lot of dialogue and a lot of characters in it, and you have to sort of remember how different people speak, and, you know, I do enjoy it. I love reading aloud. I love reading short stories and things like that onto tape. I just think it's how we first started, isn't it? Gathered round the fire telling stories.
Is it important to see your books now available in a format that someone can access even if they don't have a relationship with the printed word?
Absolutely. I think of all things I've ever written, this is, because it's basically poetry and speeches that are sort of dramatic, supposed to be, you know, personified by a character in a play. So obviously they're to be sounded out, really.
I played Ophelia in 1980 at the Royal Court in Sloane Square, London. Jonathan Pryce was the extraordinary edgy Hamlet, and it was directed by Richard Eyre. The brief at the royal court at that time was to give new writing the stature of the classics, and classic works a contemporary spin. With its secular take on ghosts and notions of heaven, hell, and purgatory, and its atmosphere of an oppressive political state, our production fulfilled that brief and was dubbed the Hamlet of the 80s. It may seem nothing new now, but it was a breakthrough production and a natural progression for me from the political fringe into the legit London theatre scene. I was daunted by the starry company I was in. Besides Jonathan, there was Jill Bennett playing Gertrude and Michael Elphick as Claudius, and the poet Christopher Logue writing his own speech as the player king. But I loved playing the part. Ophelia gets to express all her anger and bewilderment and her broken heart in the outlet that is her mad scene. Not so poor Gertrude.
She Speaks What Shakespeare's Women Might Have Said by Dame Harriet Walter is available commercially in all formats, including audio as read by Harriet herself. And Dame Harriet will be back at the end of today's show with quite a unique Books of My Life. In a moment, we'll hear some recorded highlights from sports commentator Dougie Donnelly. But before that, and in the spirit of the Boswell Book Festival, let's find some new biographies in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Another World by Melvyn Bragg was donated by Hachette.
It was the crowding of the colleges in the centre of the city that made it such an intriguing cat's cradle. This might seem near preposterous, but in Oxford, the city, the streets, the sights and the sights, I soon felt the comfort I felt in wandering through the streets, multiple alleys, gimbals and unnamed yards of my hometown of Wigton. There was the same experience, pleasure, in being in such a maze of a place. In Oxford, the attraction was bonded with learning. In Wigton, it was cemented in community. Whatever was at work from the beginning, I felt that Oxford was as easy as your old shoe, unfailingly unique, its studious serenity long achieved and signed off, like the blessing at the close of Anglican evensong. By limiting itself to one constant aim, it included everything. And the city itself was embraced by a coil of rivers, given lungs by parks and pastures, encircled by history, a miniature kingdom. Just to walk the streets was to feel good. And if the black dog was biting, or when a fat thumb was pressing down on a brain bruise, then all the more reason to go out and roam, just as I would embrace the open countryside of Cumbria, and wait for the force of place to rub away the depression. Oxford's mellow stone labyrinth did that.
Having won a scholarship to Oxford University, 18-year-old Melvyn Bragg leaves his hometown of Wigton to travel south and immerse himself in a new and golden world. There he must find his place among the raucous public school boys and the students fresh from national service, making new friends from varied backgrounds, but never forgetting those at home. Over three formative years, as his tutors, his studies and the people around him all expand his horizons and his sense of what is possible, he takes his next steps into adulthood, surrounded by the old imposing buildings and libraries and protests and parties of the city of dreaming spires. In this moment of change for a young man and for the nation, Bragg looks to the past and the future as he studies history in his tutorials, so he remembers the history of families, friends and lovers that shaped his own story. Alive with insight and tenderness, Another World beautifully captures a decisive step in a remarkable life.
The university was seductive. It was not entirely unlike falling for someone, sewn into my immediate idealization of the place. It is still there in fresh memory, more than 60 years on, undiminished. A citadel of learning, a testament to what is good, perhaps what is unique about us, ceaseless curiosity, reaching out to know the answers to the ancient and modern questions that may never be solved, or rather like walking in the Lake District, where you come, as you think, to the top of a fell, only to look ahead and see, waiting for you, another higher, unvisited fell, and welcome it. The only previous occasions on which I had sat at long tables eating with scores of strangers was at Butlin's Air, 3 years running in the early 1950s. The splendid Jacobean Hall at Wadham College worked on a similar principle. Shovel them in, feed them up, and usher them out. The key difference was that those who occupied the long, hard university benches were exclusively young men, row on row, black gowned, collar and tie, there for education, not entertainment. At Butlin's, we would follow red coats around the campsite in the evening, singing, "Please put a penny on the drum. We haven't got a tanner to buy a new piano, so please put a penny on the drum. Come and join us. Come and join us," we sang as we walked through that enchanted world. We entered the hall for lunch and dinner at Wadham less exuberantly, but there was a resemblance. Butlin's was Oxford, the carnival.
Another World by Melvyn Bragg is read by Simon Slater and runs for 7 hours and 33 minutes.
Star Child, My Life Under the Night Sky by Maggie Adderin Pocock was given to us by Penguin Random House.
For the last 50 or so years, pretty much my entire life, I believed I was born 3 weeks past my due date. In fact, I use this as a reason why I was always late for things. It's not my fault, I would think, and sometimes say out loud. It's how I arrived in this world, and it's how I have navigated through it. Eternally behind, shouting to everyone, "Don't worry, guys, I'll catch you up." It was only recently that my mother, sorting through old medical paperwork, did a double take and realised she'd been wrong. She had muddled me up with one of my sisters. I had arrived bang on time. I was a bit miffed for a while. Not only did this put a different slant on the photograph of me being valiantly held aloft by my elder sister, her skinny legs braced to hold the weight of a cannonball-heavy baby, but it also meant that I had lost what I thought was the perfect excuse for tardiness. Most importantly, something I had believed about myself for as long as I had existed turned out to be incorrect.
Maggie Adderin Pocock's destiny was always written in the stars. From the age of 3, inspired by the Clangers, her dream was to go into space. Throughout a chaotic childhood, ricocheting between divorced parents and acrimonious custody battles, she attended 13 schools in 14 years. But while her environment regularly changed, her fascination with the universe did not. It became enmeshed in her desire to succeed as a scientist, even when her school career's advice was to become a nurse. Star Child is Maggie's emotionally honest and revealing memoir, telling a story of education and prejudice, adversity and ambition, motherhood and the moon, all recounted in her characteristically warm and relatable style. From being the only black woman on her physics course at Imperial College London, to her groundbreaking work on the James Webb and Gemini telescopes, to starting her own public speaking company and sharing the wonders of science with thousands of children every year, Maggie's story will inspire you to never give up on your dreams.
While this new information was hardly life-changing, it did make me think about my process of writing this memoir. I realised I need to turn a spotlight on everything I thought to be true and investigate parts of my life that had become an amusing anecdote I rolled out or a haunting spectre I skimmed over. I had to find out where I stored my deepest feelings and hold them up to the light to be looked at, not just by me, but by anyone who listens to this book. To be frank, the idea filled me with low-level dread. My job was not just to recount my story in as interesting and fun way as possible, peppered with the usual failures, successes and affirmations, of which there are several corkers. But to excavate and interrogate my responses, which I may have buried along the way. What did I really think about my childhood, my family, my career, and myself? While I didn't see this book process as a form of therapy, what use would it be unless I was searingly honest? I am a scientist. I deal in facts. And yet, I can be just as enthralled by the mysteries of the universe as I am by the reality of the planet we live on. So, here was my starting point, to straddle the two realms of information and emotion. I'm also severely dyslexic. I read and write in bite-sized chunks, so the chapters of this book contain short pieces and vignettes rather than long, rolling, dense texts. It's how my brain works, just put down on the page. A dear colleague of mine, whom I used to work with, referred to hindsight as his retrospectroscope, a made-up word which I fell in love with and has since become part of my lexicon. To me, it conjures up the image of a powerful instrument that focuses its lens on past situations and looks at them retrospectively, with the light of today's knowledge. I've imagined packing one in my bag as I set out on this quest, time-travelling through the decades, beginning at a point just beyond my existence.
Starchild by Maggie Atherton-Pocock is read by the author and runs for 8 hours and 28 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
If you've ever watched golf or snooker or football or the Olympics on TV, you'll know the voice of my next guest. Dougie Donnelly is one of Scotland's most successful and best-loved broadcasters. He spent over 32 years with the BBC as a presenter on Sports Scene in Scotland and UK-wide on Grandstand. He's commentated on World Cups, on both Summer and Winter Olympics, on Grand Slam rugby matches, Commonwealth Games, and he's even interviewed an American president on stage at the Royal Albert Hall. Dougie's book is called Recorded Highlights, My Life in Sport. And of course, he read the audio version.
If my life had worked out as I had planned all those years ago, I would probably now be a retired solicitor, spending my days playing golf, watching sport, and enjoying my grandchildren. I would never have broadcast on 7 Olympic Games, 3 World Cups, 3 Commonwealth Games, over 300 golf tournaments, and 33 consecutive Scottish Cup finals. I would probably never have walked on the Great Wall of China, climbed the Sydney Harbour Bridge, strolled across Red Square and Moscow, and visited close to 60 countries all over the world. I wouldn't have spoken at dinners in the House of Lords or on a North Sea oil platform, or interviewed an American president on stage at the Royal Albert Hall, or 3 of the Beatles. I certainly wouldn't be on first-name terms with some of the most famous sportsmen and women in the world, many of whom have become good friends. Lucky? You better believe it. And all this, and more, happened because a DJ didn't turn up at a student union disco one Saturday night in 1974. I think I surprised myself, to be honest, because, yeah, it'd always been in the back of my mind to do a book, and then enough people said over a long enough period of time, you really should write a book. You've been a lucky so-and-so, you've been everywhere, you've met everyone, you've done so much good sport, you really should do a book. And I kept saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then COVID hit, and everybody had all this time in their hands. So I settled down, and I was very lucky because I've always kept diaries. Not got up in the morning, took the dog for a walk diary, but I've always kept. So it was actually relatively easy to go back and find all the information. So that's how it came about.
World Cup 1998, a familiar story. The Spanish referee blew his whistle on a warm Parisian afternoon, and the 1998 World Cup was underway. It was no surprise that Brazil, the defending champions and 4-time winners, were involved in the tournament's opening match, but thrillingly, their opponents on this great sporting occasion were Scotland.
Standing on the TV gantry in Paris's Stade de France that famous afternoon, I breathed a sigh of relief. The two-hour build-up to the kick-off had gone well, and even though I had been dealt a major shock earlier in the programme, we were ready to go. As planned, I had thanked my guests, Ali McCoist, Gordon Smith and Willie Miller, and handed over to Barry Davis, the BBC Network's commentator for the opening ceremony. But as the introductory music blared out in the stadium, there was only silence on the BBC Scotland feed. For reasons I never discovered, Barry's commentary was going to the rest of the UK, but not to the huge audience back in Scotland, waiting for one of the great occasions in our football history.
Now, it's called Recorded Highlights. What are some of your personal highlights?
Goodness me, I suppose getting to 7 Olympic Games, which was obviously a huge privilege, commentating in 2 British gold medals, the lovely Rona and the girls in the curling, and Stephanie Cook in the modern pentathlon in Sydney. And I did World Cups highlight. I mean, things like Scotland's rugby players winning 2 Grand Slams was great. Interviewing the Scot that had just won the Open Golf, which was always an ambition. And I was always thinking, well, it'll be Monty or it'll be Sam. And of course, it was Paul Laurie. So standing in the 18th at Carnoustie and interviewing Paul as the Scottish Open champion was pretty special. But I've been so lucky, but there have been so many. Which I've never been ambitious in the sense that this is what I want to do. I want to be a broadcaster. I want to be a sports presenter. It just all kind of fell into place. I've been so lucky. And the book title's misleading, by the way. It says My Life in Sport. And the first, I don't know, 2 or 3 chapters is more about my life in music, you know, because I was a DJ, obviously. Loved radio then and still do. So there's a lot about my musical tastes and adventures as well.
I was going to ask, is there going to be a sequel called My Life in Music?
That's not a bad idea, actually. Could I stretch that to a book? I maybe could, to be honest, because it was in the early days of Radio Clyde, which had just got on the air, which was a huge success story, obviously. And I got to meet Paul McCartney and Elton John and so many superstars. And through that, got into TV. But yeah, as I say, the book title is a little bit misleading. If you're not into sport, but you like music, there'll be something in there for you.
Panic immediately broke out in the BBC Scotland control truck outside the stadium, as plugs and circuits between Paris and Glasgow were checked. But eventually, I got the apologetic instruction in my earpiece. Doogie, you're going to have to commentate. I was only too well aware from previous Olympic and World Cup opening ceremonies that these huge extravaganzas featured a cast of hundreds amid music, drama, lots of obscure symbolism and proud tributes to the host nation's culture. The commentator would spend days preparing an explanatory script to interpret it all to an often baffled audience, and would certainly have watched the full-scale rehearsal in the stadium the day before. I had nothing, and not a clue as to what was already unfolding in front of me. The French, after all, love their impressionists.
If you're driving up to a golf course, up north somewhere or down south, what's on the stereo? What are you listening to?
Oh, good question. Do you know what? I don't listen to podcasts very much because old school, I find them sometimes a little bit self-indulgent and a little bit unproduced. But no, I listen to music. I'm still a huge fan of Paul Simon, Rod Stewart, the kind of stuff you would expect someone of my age maybe to enjoy. Steely Dan was always a great favourite. Bonnie Raitt, who have I missed? I'm looking at my wife because she determines my musical tastes a lot of the time.
Now, live broadcasting can be a seat of your pants thing. Any time where it's going badly, badly wrong?
Not terribly wrong. No, we all, as you know, we all say things, you know, oh, that didn't come out quite the way I intended it. Nothing terribly, terribly awful, but the one I remember particularly was the opening match of the World Cup in 1998, Scotland against Brazil, and the Stade de France in Paris doesn't get any bigger. And I was there just to do the match coverage with Ali McCoist and Willie Miller, I think. But the BBC had some horrendous problem, and BBC Scotland had the pictures but not the commentary on the opening ceremony, which Barry Davis was doing for all of the BBC. And I get this panic stricken in my ear, you know, Doogie, you're going to have to commentate on the opening ceremony. And luckily I had a few notes that I'd picked up in the media centre, but I had to talk for however long the opening ceremony was, it felt like about 3 weeks, about this strange French impressionist, you know, opening ceremony. And that was an absolute panic because I hadn't done my homework because I wasn't intending to do it. So that was a tough one. That's maybe the worst I've felt on here.
Now, the book, you read the audio version of the book, yes, as a broadcaster, there must have been a walk in the park.
I don't know about a walk in the park, but the producer was very complimentary. He said, well, you can tell that this is what you do for a living. You know, I was able to get through it, and I can't remember the times now, but he said, well, allow about 3 days for this, actually. And I think I did it in less than one, you know, or something like that.
That's just showing off.
I suppose it is, really. But yeah, it's what I do, so give me some words to say, and I'll say them, yeah.
Is it important now that there is an audio version that's available for people for whatever reason don't have a relationship with the printed word?
Absolutely right. I'm always intrigued as to what you guys do, and I think audiobooks have been a boon to people with sight problems, and it was an absolute pleasure to do it, and hopefully your listeners and everyone else who enjoys audiobooks will enjoy it.
Thankfully, I did have, somewhere in the bottom of the bag lying at my feet, the thick wad of bilingual explanations which was the running order for the ceremony. For some reason, I had picked it up as I left the broadcast centre hours before, not thinking for a moment that I would need it. I was much more interested in Craig Brown's team selection and any tricky Brazilian pronunciations. Now that creased and dog-eared sheaf of notes was a lifesaver. As I fumbled for the right page, thinking, come on, Dougie, we need words, I tried to reassure myself with the old adage, less is more, along with only speak when you can add to the pictures. An old-fashioned concept now, in these days of wall-to-wall words from the commentary box. Somehow I got through it, the words just about making sense, if lacking the polished articulacy which I'm sure Barry gave to the network commentary. Then, and with only the briefest word of acknowledgement from the production team, we were straight into the last 20 minutes of the build-up to Scotland versus Brazil. And bizarrely, after that initial panic, I actually enjoyed it all. Unscripted, seat-of-the-pants broadcasting with no autocue, no meaningful running order, and no idea what you might have to suddenly describe. Live television is what I do. Almost all the TV I have presented in my long career has been live, and I love it.
Dougie Donnelly, Recorded Highlights, My Life in Sport, is available in print, as an e-book, and in audio commercially now. Thanks once again to the lovely Dougie Donnelly. Now, we've got a rather unique Books of My Life coming up in a moment with Dame Harriet Walter, but before that, let's take another visit to find some books you may have missed in the RNIB library.
We recently acquired The Lives of Lee Miller by Anthony Penrose.
Lee Miller, fashion model. Lee Miller, photographer. Lee Miller, war correspondent. Lee Miller, writer. Lee Miller, aficionado of classical music. Lee Miller, haute cuisine cook. Lee Miller, traveller. In all her different worlds, she moved with freedom. In all her roles, she was her own, bold self. A paradox of irascibility and effusive warmth, of powerful talent and hopeless incapability. Lee rode her own temperament through life as if she were clinging to the back of a runaway dragon. Sometimes the dragon triumphed and Lee was plunged into bleak, weeping despair. But mostly she took control and won a close-run victory against herself first and adversity second. Her successes always left an enduring impression. She loved to learn, create or take part, and then move on to something else. Some of her jags, as she called her current obsessions, would last only days. Others stretched for years.
Beautiful, bewitching, and an exceptionally good photographer, Lee Miller was one of life's adventurers. She became a Vogue cover girl in 1920s New York before embracing Paris, photography, and surrealism. and then dramatically changed her life yet again, reinventing herself as a war correspondent, notably covering the liberation of Dachau. These are but three of the many lives of Lee Miller. Penrose's tribute to his mother brings to life a uniquely talented woman and the turbulent times in which she lived.
Photography was her supreme jag, and she deserted it only when, after 30 years, she had exhausted all its abilities to provide excitement. Lee's spread of interests amounted to much more than the desultory pecking of a dilettante. Whatever she became involved in, her commitment was total, and the consequence to herself and others was of only minor consideration. Though Lee had an immense capacity to learn from other people, few can be seen to have had much influence on her. She herself changed little as she moved among the giant-sized characters that peopled her different worlds. The core of her character had been assembled, stamped and sealed for life at an early age under the supervision of a remarkable mechanical engineer, her father, Theodore Miller. Theodore Miller was descended from a Hessian soldier who settled in Lancaster, Pennsylvania after the Revolution. His father was a bricklayer from Richmond, Indiana, but Theodore started his working life as a machine operator making wooden wheels for roller skates. With tenacious application, he worked his way into progressively better jobs with the help of qualifications obtained through the International Correspondence School. In later years, when accused of being stubborn, he would dismissively say that stubbornness was just applied determination. This willfulness, an insatiable curiosity about all things mechanical and scientific, and a completely unabashed manner of asking questions were traits that his daughter inherited.
The Lives of Lee Miller by Anthony Penrose is read by Esther Wayne and Adam Grayson and runs for 7 hours and 14 minutes.
Recently released as a film, Star of Acre by Andrew Michael Hurley was given to us by John Murray from the Hachette Publishing Group.
Overnight, snow had fallen thickly again in Crofton Dale, and now in the morning the fells on the other side of the valley were pure white against the sky. Further down, where the sun had not yet reached, the wood by the beck was steeped in shadow and would stay cold all day. The freezing mist that was twined between the leafless beech and birch had already driven a hungry fox to seek food elsewhere. A line of deep paw prints came out of the gloom and into the pearly light that washed over the drifts on this side of the dale. Yet the animal seemed to have changed direction abruptly, startled into a hollow or a ditch by the folk out shooting nearby. Men from Micklebrow, probably, who'd walked over the moor to take advantage of the wide, empty canvas, on which the grouse and pheasants were as bright as streaks of paint.
The worst thing possible has happened. Richard and Juliet Willoughby's son, Ewan, has died suddenly at the age of 5. Star of Acre, their house by the moors, was to be full of life, but is now a haunted place. Juliet, convinced Ewan still lives there in some form, seeks the help of the Beacons, a seemingly benevolent group of occultists. Richard, to try and keep the boy out of his mind, has turned his attention to the field opposite the house, where he patiently digs the barren dirt in search of a legendary oak tree. It is a novel about the way in which grief splits the world in two, and how, in searching for hope, we can so easily unearth horror.
The sound of shotguns and whistles doubled in air that was uncannily still and expectant after the blizzard. The storm had lasted for hours, and the extent of its fury was marked by icy cornices blown over the dry stone walls. They were wild, jagged crests, like those of a sea surge breaking on inadequate defences. So the winter went on, adding to itself day by day. making the houses in the dale seem even more remote from one another than usual. None of the farmers had been out yet with a plough, and on the road by Starve Acre, the snow cleared the evening before had frozen solid. All along the verges it was piled like crumbled pieces of cumulus.
Starve Acre by Andrew Michael Hurley is read by Richard Burnett and runs for 5 hours and 56 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Now, I didn't realise this at the time of recording, but never before in books of my life have all the book clips been read by the guest. So here is the Books of My Life from Dame Harriet Walter.
Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Probably something very corny about animals, because I loved animals. Off the top of my head, and you're all going to laugh, there was a book called Tally Ho, and it was about a beautiful pony, and, you know, I was into riding and the countryside, and it made me cry, because it was very sad. And I just found it rather miraculous that you could reach my feelings through just black marks on a white piece of paper. You know, I still find that quite miraculous.
Unfortunately, the book Tally Ho, The Story of an Irish Hunter by Moira Charlton, is long since out of print and no audio version exists.
Is there a book that's a comfort reread? On a rainy day, there's a book you'll always reach for.
There isn't really, because I have to say I'm a very slow reader and I'm a very busy person, and I find that I love the idea that I know lots of people do of rereading and rereading their favourite books. Part of me is frightened to reread a book that I know that I've always loved, just in case I go back to it. But I tell you, I do go back to Dickens a lot. And I know, not, you know, there are things people don't like about Dickens, but I love the way he switches from sort of social polemic to absurd comedy to very serious stuff or scary stuff. And he switches. He's a dramatist, really, isn't he? And his novels are dramatic and they or filmic, really. And I do go back to him if I want to just dip in and read a chunk.
You have narrated Dickens before?
I think I read Hard Times once. And it's quite difficult, so you have to do all the men. And I think I read Hard Times.
Now what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children. And this is the principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts, sir.
The scene was a plain, bare, monotonous vault of a schoolroom. The speaker, Thomas Gradgrind, and the schoolmaster, and the third grown person present, swept with their eyes the inclined plane of little vessels then and there arranged in order, ready to have imperial gallons of facts poured into them until they were full to the brim. Indeed, as Mr. Gradgrind sparkled at them, he seemed a kind of cannon loaded to the muzzle with facts, and prepared to blow them clean out of the regions of childhood at one discharge.
"Girl number 20," said Mr. Gradgrind, squarely pointing with his square forefinger. "I don't know that girl. Who is that girl?"
"Sissy Jupe, sir," explained number 20, blushing, standing up and curtsying.
"Cecilia Jupe. Let me see. What is your father?"
"He belongs to the horse riding, if you please, sir." Mr. Gradgrind frowned.
"You mustn't tell us about that. We don't want to know anything about that here. Your father breaks horses, don't he? Very well, then. Describe your father as a horse breaker. He doctors sick horses, I dare say."
Oh, yes, sir.
Very well, then. He's a veterinary surgeon and a horse breaker. So, give me a definition of a horse.
Sissy Jupe, thrown into the greatest alarm by this demand.
Girl number 20 unable to define a horse, said Mr. Gradgrind. Girl number 20 possessed of no facts in reference to one of the commonest of animals. Some boy's definition of a horse.
The square finger moving here and there lighted suddenly on Bitzer. Whereas the girl had been so dark-eyed and dark-haired that she seemed to receive a deep and lustrous colour from the sun shining through the windows, this boy was so light-eyed and light-haired that the self-same rays appeared to draw out of him what little colour he possessed. He had cold eyes, pale, cropped hair, and skin so unwholesomely deficient in the natural tinge that he looked as though, if he were cut, he would bleed white.
Bitzer, said Thomas Gradgrind, your definition of a horse.
Quadruped, graminivorous, 40 teeth, sheds coat in the spring in marshy countries, hoofs hard but requiring to be shod with iron, age known by marks in mouth. Thus, and much more, Bitzer.
Now, girl number 20, said Mr. Gradgrind, you know what a horse is.
That's my guest, Harriet Walter, reading Hard Times, written by Charles Dickens. That is a 3-hour abridgment that is available commercially. The version in the RNIB Talking Books Library runs for 10 hours, 11 minutes, and it's read by Paterson Joseph.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Well, I was going to say Atonement by Ian McEwan because I read it ages ago. I was in the film and then was asked to do the audiobook. And in reading the audiobook, knowing the end, I found all sorts of secret, clever little things he was doing in the writing that was a hint to what the end was going to be, but that you would never have noticed if you were just on the first run. You would only really know how clever that was if you went back to read it again.
Did you keep the surprise out your voice?
Oh, trying to, yes, yes. But, oh my God, there's a bit I didn't get. No, it's a revelation that you get something different out of reading something on the page and sounding it out and watching it in a film or whatever. They're all different ways of ingesting the same story.
The play, for which Bryony had designed the posters, programs and tickets, constructed the sales booth out of a folding screen tipped on its side and lined the collection box in red crepe paper, was written by her in a 2-day tempest of composition, causing her to miss a breakfast and a lunch. When the preparations were complete, she had nothing to do but contemplate her finished draft and wait for the appearance of her cousins from the distant north. There would be time for only one day of rehearsal before her brother arrived. At some moments chilling, at others desperately sad, the play told a tale of the heart, whose message, conveyed in a rhyming prologue, was that love, which did not build a foundation on good sense, was doomed. The reckless passion of the heroine, Arabella, for a wicked foreign count, is punished by ill fortune when she contracts cholera during an impetuous dash towards a seaside town with her intended. Deserted by him and nearly everybody else, bed-bound in a garret, she discovers in herself a sense of humour. Fortune presents her a second chance in the form of an impoverished doctor. In fact, a prince in disguise who has elected to work among the needy. Healed by him, Arabella chooses judiciously this time and is rewarded by reconciliation with her family and a wedding with the medical prince. On a windy, sunlit day in spring, Mrs. Tallis read the 7 pages of The Trials of Arabella in her bedroom at her dressing table, with the author's arm around her shoulder the whole while. Bryony studied her mother's face for every trace of shifting emotion. and Emily Tallis obliged, with looks of alarm, snickers of glee, and at the end, grateful smiles and wise affirming nods. She took her daughter in her arms, onto her lap. Ah, that hot, smooth little body she remembered from its infancy. And still not gone from her, not quite yet. And said that the play was stupendous. And agreed instantly, murmuring into the tight hall of the girl's ear, that this word could be quoted on the poster, which was to be on an easel in the entrance hall by the ticket booth. Bryony was hardly to know it then, but this was the project's highest point of fulfilment. Nothing came near it for satisfaction. All else was dreams and frustration. There were moments in the summer dusk, after her light was out, burrowing in the delicious gloom of her canopy bed, when she made her heart thud with luminous, yearning fantasies. Little playlets in themselves, every one of which featured Leon. In one, his big, good-natured face buckled in grief as Arabella sank in loneliness and despair. In another, there he was, cocktail in hand, at some fashionable city watering hole, overheard boasting to a group of friends, "Yes, my younger sister, Bryony Tallis, the writer. You must surely have heard of her." In a third, he punched the air in exultation as the final curtain fell, although there was no curtain. There was no possibility of a curtain. Her play was not for her cousins, it was for her brother. To celebrate his return, provoke his admiration, and guide him away from his careless succession of girlfriends towards the right form of wife, the one who would persuade him to return to the countryside, the one who would sweetly request Bryony's services as a bridesmaid.
Atonement by Ian McEwan is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by my guest, Harriet Walter. That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. Thanks once again to everyone at the Boswell Book Festival and everyone at Dumfries House. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there's almost 500 episodes of Read On available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. And remember our sister show, Talking Books, every weekday at 2 or 10, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.